Chapter 14, The Journey to the Screen. There have, of course, been numerous film versions of Victor Hugo's novel, dating back 100 years, but never a cinematic version of the musical. In 1912, Henry Krauss starred as Jean Valjean for the director Albert Capellani's silent version, and later played Monseigneur Myriel in Raymond Bernard's 1934 adaptation. Hollywood first took up the challenge in 1935, with Charles Laughton being nominated for an Oscar as Javert, and then again in 1952, when American director Louis Milestone cast Michael Rennie as Valjean and fellow Brit Robert Newton as his nemesis Javert. I added up all the film and television versions of Les Miserables that have been done, including The Fugitive, which is a modern retelling of the story, and there are over 40, said Cameron Mackintosh. Every few years, someone would say, I want to do my version of Les Miserables, but no one has ever done a musical, until now. Hollywood is always on the lookout for a powerful, emotional story that will resonate with a mass audience. And in 1987, New York was buzzing as Les Miserables played sell-out shows day after day at the Broadway Theatre. With advanced ticket sales of $12 million, a phenomenal sum at the time, Les Miserables was a guaranteed success, and the power players in California duly took note and beat a path to Mackintosh's door. Columbia TriStar, at that time relatively new on the Hollywood scene, had been set up by the studio giant Sony Pictures and was looking for hot projects to establish its credentials. Les Miserables fitted the bill perfectly. It was right at the birth of TriStar and they wanted the rights, said Mackintosh, and I said that yes, I would be interested depending on who directed it. Mackintosh wanted Alan Parker, the British director who had directed Fame and Bugsy Malone. Alan was booked to do it, Mackintosh recalled, and I thought he was a great choice, a great director who understood the music. We even took out ads in the trade papers announcing it. But although Mackintosh was keen on the film project, he was also understandably protective of his stage show. He did not want a film to appear too soon because that, potentially, could have damaged the Broadway and London productions. I was adamant that we wouldn't make the film immediately because we had just opened the show on Broadway, so I said, look, it can't be released for a few years. And they agreed that we would wait and make it 5 years after the Broadway opening. On stage, Les Miserables went from strength to strength, and the film was put on a back burner. A couple of other directors came on board, but it never got there, said Mackintosh. And thank God it didn't happen then, is all I can say. I didn't despair, because within a few years, I had 15 productions of Les Miserables running around the world. That is, still today, a record for simultaneous productions running at one time. I was just thrilled that the movie rights came back to me from TriStar because it hadn't been made, and at that time musicals on film weren't nearly as popular. As Mackintosh pointed out, over the years other musicals have paved the way for Les Miserables to be adapted for the screen. I think we're making this movie now because Baz Luhrmann did Moulin Rouge, Evita was made, Chicago went to the big screen, and Mamma Mia was a huge hit. With all of those, the appetite for the film musical has grown. In 2010, Mackintosh felt that it was the right time to push the film project forward. He approached Working Title, the British-based film production company with a hugely successful track record, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Dead Man Walking, Elizabeth, Bridget Jones's Diary, Pride and Prejudice, Anna Karenina, and many more. He met with Eric Fellner, Tim Bevan, and Deborah Haywood, who would all become producers on the film. Working Title has a long and fruitful partnership with Universal, the American studio, who would greenlight the project. Cameron brought Les Miserables to Working Title in early 2010, and we started looking for a writer to adapt it for the screen. We all agreed that Bill Nicholson would be perfect for the screenplay, said Haywood. Nicholson, who has twice been nominated for an Oscar, was also crucial in bringing director Tom Hooper on board. The writer mentioned that he was also working on Les Miserables, and Hooper was immediately intrigued. He took himself off to see the London stage show and, through his contacts at Working Title, let it be known that he was very, very interested in directing the movie. Independently, Eric Fellner was thinking along the same lines, as he recalled. We got a screenplay from Bill and I had just seen The King's Speech. It was at that first screening in 2010, and I remember going to that early screening and seeing Tom and thinking, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could find something for him? Then it turned out that Tom and Bill were actually friends, and Bill had mentioned it to Tom, and we thought, well, this would be the perfect choice. Although the King's speech had not yet been generally released, there was a considerable buzz building on both sides of the Atlantic. McIntosh met Hooper, and the two men clearly hit it off. That was before the King's speech came out, but one of the things that impressed me about Tom was that he took it on himself to go and see the show, and I heard from Deborah and Eric that Tom was very interested, said McIntosh. I'd seen The Damned United and liked that, and then I saw the King's speech and liked that very much too. But when the King's speech became such a huge success, I sat back and thought, it may well have been the film he wanted to make before, but who knows if he will still want to when he's won an Oscar. The King's speech did indeed do well at the Oscars, and Hooper was now a highly sought-after filmmaker. The question was, would he still want to direct Les Miserables when he was receiving offers from every studio in Hollywood? There was never any doubt, said Hooper. I knew that this was the film I wanted to make, and I didn't waver from that. There were a lot of other offers, but Les Miserables was the one. Hooper was already planning how he would take Les Miserables from the stage and make it cinematic. He was passionate about the idea that his actors would perform each and every song live before the cameras, and that convinced McIntosh that he was indeed the perfect director for the project. Tom had immediately grasped where the emotional power of the story lay, said McIntosh. At the very core of this story, it's about the survival of the human spirit, and the music drives that story. It's probably the most successful adaptation of any book in the history of music. Tom was excited about how he would film those great ensemble numbers and record all the performances live. He said to me, you know, I would really like to do this live, which is what I dreamed of doing. I knew then that we had found the right man. Timing, he says, is everything. And a strong belief in fate helps too. McIntosh noted, who knows if Les Miserables had opened in any other time than the mid-1980s, whether it would have caught the public imagination in the way it did. I really believe that it is a blessing that the film wasn't made back when we first started discussing it.